Welcome to the Reformist Pipeline.
Ooh, let me not do that again. You're the reformist and the pipeline to inform your decisions on how you can support change in our education system. My name is Lindsay, affectionately known as Miss Black.
And I'm Hottie Hop, Mr. Broussard. If you're feeling travel ready, Linz,
you weren't ready for that one. You better be travel ready.
I wasn't ready. You're really good on these feelings. Okay, travel ready. Where are you going? Pretend to not know.
Yeah, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'll be headed to Greece and trying to catch up to you wherever you're at. Where are you? Because this is a perfect segue.
I am in Barcelona right now.
Yeah.
Living my best remote worker, retired teacher life.
Oh, period.
I love it for the most part. I did have an interaction today that might have been racist. Not sure. I know the racial structures are different than they are in America.
That's fair.
For the most part, I'm just really glad to be able to eat. And I don't even eat pork. But I've been eating this jamon. I'm not
Okay.
And then, you know, I've been drinking at least 2 to 3 sangria or wine beverages prior to drinking any water. And that is kind of right now. But yeah, I'm just living life. I'm walking everywhere. I almost hit my move goal twice yesterday. And I'm also still working. So
yes.
I work night hours. So my day kind of starts at 6. 6 p.m. that is, which is 9 a.m. PST. So it's just been interesting. It's been nice to be able to like wake up. I can wake up whenever I want, which is around 10, like 10 or 11 is when my body's naturally waking up.
Gotcha.
I have the full day to do stuff that I want. I'm not pressed because I'm here for like several more days. By the time y'all hear this, I'll be like about to leave in 3 days. Okay. You know, you can't live everywhere for too long. You know, I am of the world. Although I've been on a date before and a man told me I was of the world and he was a religious Christian man. These are his words, not mine. And essentially he was calling me a hoe. But that's another story for another time. Actually, I'm gonna tell that story on the Patreon. If you're listening right now, and Jahab, remind me, because I'm gonna tell that story on the Patreon so y'all know what I'm talking about. But nonetheless, Jahab, you're going to Greece.
Yes, I'm going to Greece.
But I wanted you to tell them why you're
going. I know. Yes, so I'm going to Greece for one of my good friends. She's turning 40. So I'll spend a week in Greece. And then after I go to Greece, I'll get back from the cruise. And then I fly to Barcelona and I'll be there for a couple of days. And then I will get to see the Queen, Beyonce, in Barcelona. So I'm super excited about that. I'm going with like my college friends. It's kind of crazy. Like the trip kind of blew up. It's like one of those things where I was like, oh, okay, like 2 people are going, then 4 people are going, then 6 people are going. So I'm also trying to encourage anybody and everyone who's in Europe during the same time to pull up on me. So yeah, I'm super excited. I'm super, super excited about this trip.
You should be. I feel like Barcelona is like really good with a group of people that, you know, I always feel that way about spaces. But, you know, it's monumental for Black people to be able to be in a large group and actually get the payments done, get all the stuff done. But because I know your people, it doesn't surprise me, but still.
But the thing is that the best part about it was that we all did our own thing kind of separately. And I think that that's the type of traveler that I'm learning that I like being is like, because I'm a points person, Linz knows this, like I'm a Marriott boy through and through. I have status with American. So like, those are what I typically do. And so like, I like booking my own trip, in the sense of like my hotel, my flight, and I'll meet y'all there. We will see each other when we get there. You can go and do what you want to do after, but like, we'll have different meetup and hangout points. Like that's what I'm looking forward to, especially because like, this is something that I didn't really get to lean into when I was an undergrad. I was working too damn much, but anyways, you know, there's always time for what needs to happen. And so now is the time for me to go on another Europe tour. So I'm excited.
I'm super excited for you too.
But the reason why I said it was a perfect segue earlier of with this man saying that you're of the world, whatever he meant by that, we can can't wait to hear that story again. The reason why I said it's the perfect segue is because we're going into a religious and spirituality episode, and we have one of my really good friends, Brandon, who's going to really jump in and talk about all the things that need to be discussed. So yeah, that's all I'm gonna say, because y'all gonna do a lot of reflecting this episode. That's all I got to say about that.
Let's get into it.
And if you don't know, now you know, we're rolling into the concept development. And as you know, we know we're going to be talking about religion and spirituality. And I have my friend, someone who I look at as just like, he just brings me so much joy. And I also have told people this so many different times that this is going to be probably the person who either is going to be the preacher of the church that I'm going to attend, or that's going to be the person who's going to... the ordained minister. But I will let him give an introduction. So without further ado, I will let you do your thing, Mr. Brandon, Mr. Cox.
Thank you. I'm Brandon, Brandon Cox. I am currently a chaplain here at UVA Health. And I am a practicing Christian. So don't cut me off just yet. Give me a chance. I promise you it gets better.
Please. Love it. Love it, love it, love it. No, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we're super excited to have you here today. I think that your perspective is something that I have always loved to hear more about. We have a friend in common by the name of Michael Booth, who actually was on our first season, right when we came, I think we were going into the pandemic at that time, unfortunately.
Triggered.
Sorry to, okay. Sorry to bring that up. Sorry. Trigger warning. But yeah, all that to say, I'm super excited to have you, and I really want to jump straight into this conversation. So
Before we jump into
yes,
it, your right, fun right. fact.
Yeah, what is your fun fact, please?
All right, my fun fact. I like honey o' bay wings with the garlic parmesan dip flavor from Wingstop. I know that people don't like Wingstop, but they have this little garlic parmesan flavor. They don't.
I feel like, but you're talking to Californians, so I feel like we resonate with Wingstop. That's us. I would definitely have to say that. Yeah.
Michael does like Wingstop.
See? It's a Cali thing. It's a Cali thing.
Wait, so garlic parmesan dip?
Yeah, not like, it's like they say they toss the wings in it, but they really don't. But it's literally like butter, parmesan cheese, and I don't know, something else is probably artificial, and it's great. So...
And I'm gonna eat it.
Okay. That does sound really good. I may have to look into that tonight. But yes, like I was saying, we're gonna jump into this episode, this concept development. So Brandon, I would love to, you kicked off the episode in a way in which I would love for you to tell a little bit more about why do you feel like you have to lead with, don't cut me off just yet. Tell me more about that.
So, I mean, in this day and age, we realize that the fabric of our country was birthed from this westernized American Christianity. And we realize that Christianity was, during the slave trade, during enslavement, was weaponized against us to control us, to cause us to believe that we were inferior. And so oftentimes, as time has gone on, a lot of Black folks, a lot of people of color have decided that Christianity is just not the way. Like, we can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. And so for me to still be a practicing Christian implicates me in some ways to be of the oppressor class. That was from a tweet that I saw the other day. So shout out to whoever tweeted that. I think it's important that I acknowledge and name the privilege that I have as a Christian in this country where Christianity is supreme. I say that not to cut me off, because the ways that I practice Christianity is one of deconstruction, of a reconstruction, if you will, in a way that is indicative, or it represents my lived reality as a Black man. So I start off there because I was raised in Birmingham, Alabama, by my mother, my grandmother, and a host of other relatives, and we went to church. And some of us know that the Black church was the forum, the public forum by which our families got all the news. It's where we talked about mm-hmm. politics at a particular time. It was a way that we got the help that we needed. It was very communal. If the bill needed to be paid, we could just call down to the church and they would mm-hmm. pay our bills. If we needed some food, the food pantry would provide for us those things so that we would have. And so I grew up in this community within my family, but within the church. And it was a Black Christianity that was very, in some ways, conservative, which could be some of the confusing mm-hmm. part of this. Christianity in this country, we know, has been used to cause folks to feel less than, whether you be Black, mm-hmm. whether you be a woman, whether you be on the spectrum of LGBTQIA+, or however you choose to identify, whether you are a child or if you are disabled, we realize that Christianity has become the premise for oppression that we experience today. And so growing up in Birmingham, I realized that my upbringing is near and dear to me. It's a part of my spiritual formation, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. And so one of the things that was important for me just from a child, you know, what is faith? You know, I know that Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. But what does that look like?
You better quote.
Okay.
Come on.
Like, what does that look like? And so, you know, growing up, we dressed up for church. And I used to wear the 16-piece suits with the 50 buttons and all the other
things. Ooh, child.
You know, I was dressed, okay? Because yeah. y'all talk about Met Gala.
To the nine.
You don't know what Easter Sunday is like, okay?
Not the Met Gala. They said, why they in it?
You worry about the Met Gala. We up here talking about Sunday morning on Easter. And so, like, I dressed up a lot. And so people used to say, like, oh, you go be a little preacher. You go be a little preacher. And I felt something. I felt like there was something more to that. You know, it wasn't just my dress. It wasn't just, you know, going every day, you know, Sunday morning, Bible study on Wednesdays, choir rehearsals on Thursdays, some youth event on Friday, cleaning up on Saturdays. And I didn't really do that much, but I know that's what people say. But it was more than that for me.
Yeah.
And so I used to watch my grandmother take notes. You know, I used to be like, you know, what are you doing while the pastor's talking? I mean, to the point where I would write every word he said and got frustrated because I couldn't keep up. And so it was my grandmother.
Oh, baby.
I mean, I was pissed. I was just like, dang, he going too fast. He just said the title. And my grandmother would be like, well, he's going to give a title. He's going to give you 3 points. And he's going to give you an A, B, and C. And he's going to close.
A teaching moment. Come on, right. Grandma.
A teaching moment.
Yes.
You know, and that happened in the Black church, you know, in my Black church experience. And so from then on, I started going to Sunday school. We started going to Bible study. I became active in the youth council. And so I began to, you know, take leadership roles while also serving in this teaching space. I mean, it was very spiritual, very refreshing, but also it was a teaching space. It's where I learned to do public speaking. It's where I learned to be prompt. It's where I learned how to behave. It's where I learned what it means to be sacred. And so it was in that kind of grounding that I carry that with me, you know, throughout my life. And so I realized, like, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, and so I preached my first sermon. It was called Facing the Giants. It was about David and Goliath. And so from that point on, I was the little preacher, you know, going around Birmingham, preaching. I learned all the lines in the Easter plays and the Christmas plays. I sang my first solo in the church. I mean, I got so much training. Yeah. I mean, it was a memorable moment, but it was very integral to my journey has led me here.
And you know what? You said something that was very key to me in talking about your upbringing, because what I heard is that the church was a cornerstone of your development, your holistic development as a child. Whereas I think present day, a lot of that cornerstone development is happening in school buildings. And I even think I would even go as far to say, I would say that, like, yes, allegedly, and that may even be a problem as to why we need more resources in schools. But however, I digress for now. I will also say that, like, growing up on the West Coast, I didn't really feel that. I didn't really feel as if the church was the cornerstone of my development. Was I a part of a church, yes. However, I was very put off by the church. And I actually attended a church that was non-denominational in my upbringing. And one thing that they were, it was a very homophobic church. And I think that through that experience, it just kind of, I knew what I didn't want in a church. And I think it was because of that that really made me question Christianity, but it wasn't the fact that I was questioning Christianity. It was just the fact that I didn't appreciate the environment that this type of pastor was preaching. And that was something that I had to kind of unlearn and teach myself once I got to the East Coast and went to America. And I was like, oh, okay, like there are different types of denominations within Christianity. And this one believes in this. And so like that was when I was introduced to the African Methodist Episcopal, AME. As well as, and it's interesting also because my great grandfather, he was a Baptist preacher and had Sweet Home Baptist, Sweet Home Baptist Church. And so my family, my lineage was very involved in the church. And so to have had that upbringing, but to have not been as involved, but then to be in a space now where I'm like, like I identify with this, but it's a little different than what's typical and what's traditional. And why? Because of the why. Like, I want to understand the word. And not only do I want to understand the word, but I want the preacher to understand what they are preaching and understand who they may or may not be oppressing in the process of speaking just because they're speaking. And also being able to go home and be like, you know what, like, and have a conversation and to be able to unpack that why and to understand like, oh, well, I actually don't agree with this. And like, let's have a conversation about that. And it wasn't even until I had a conversation with Booth about like the difference. He was breaking down like the difference of folks who go to divinity school versus who go and study other ways to become a preacher, and like that delineation specifically, like an academic preacher versus someone who just went to, I don't know the term of the type of, is it Bible college?
Like a Bible college or like a Bible.
Okay. And not trying to denigrate in any way, shape, or form, but I'm just saying that I went to churches that were preachers had attended Bible colleges. And the first time that I went to a church where the preacher was an academic and actually studied philosophy, actually studied the Bible and from an academic lens and actually was exposed to other religions, that was a time in which I was like, well, damn, like, this is different and this feels good. This feels like you are nurturing my development, my holistic development. You're not just out here saying anything that comes to the top of your mind. So I just wanted to really say that that interfaith piece, that literally was, you were speaking to my spirit when we were speaking to how the school, how the church was literally a part of your holistic development. And even then you look back and you're like, oh, okay, like, And so I would love to even hear more about like where are you at now, Brandon? How did you get to then trying to become a chaplain? Like, why a chaplain of all the things?
So I'm glad you mentioned interfaith. And so growing up in Birmingham, I was just around all the same kind of people. You know, we were all Christian. Nobody was really making any delineation about what specifically we believed. We knew that Jesus was Lord. We knew that every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus is Lord. And as I answered my call to ministry from the age of 13, I worked my way through school, through grade school, through middle school, through high school, and then I got to college at Howard. And I tried to make my life about business and not about ministry, but then God had other plans. And so I realized that to fulfill this calling to ministry and not just to preaching, but just to ministry in general, I wanted to get a Black formal theological education. And so one of the things that I prayed about, one of my expectations going into divinity school, I went to Howard University School of Divinity in DC, was for God to stretch my theology. I wanted to be open to the possibilities. And when folks ask me what should I know? What's some advice for going to getting a professional degree theologically? Just explore the possibilities. And so it was at Howard Divinity that I was able to be exposed to not just this Christianity that was from my upbringing, that I found out later was very conservative and in a lot of ways homophobic and misogynistic and all of these things, capitalist, you know, I realized I was exposed to
grounded in patriarchy.
Listen, I was exposed to
all the isms.
All the isms and schisms and all that. And okay. I realized that there was so much more to faith or so much more to religion or spirituality than just my small worldview. And it's not to dismiss or discredit what's raised me, but it's to say that there is more. And so I took a class, Islamic studies class, that basically I had to come up with this question. How do you learn to embrace folks of other faith traditions and not just tolerate? So I was exposed to the different ways of the world, different ways that people are, the ways that people live, the ways that people find meaning in their lives. And I realized that that didn't always happen through the vessel of Christianity. And growing up in a tradition where we believe that every knee shall bow meant that every knee, all knees, whatever continent you're from, whatever culture you're from, whatever your background is, it doesn't matter. You're going to be Christian. Jesus is going to make his way to you and you're going to confess him as Lord, or you're going to go to hell. Because that's the end goal. I want to go to heaven. And if I don't accept Jesus as my Lord and Savior, I'm going to go to hell. And so when I went to divinity school, I learned that there were so many possibilities. And it wasn't just the coursework. It was the folks that I met. It was the stories that I heard. And even as I went into training to be a chaplain, I realized that my ministry was not going to solely be in a pulpit. Because I realized that there are folks that are called to that. Just like there are folks that are going to go to the Bible colleges. There are people that are going to go to the Bible institutes. And there are going to be those of us that are going to go to the seminaries and the divinity schools. And I just wanted to make the point that even if you go to these schools, it does not guarantee that your theology is going to be sound. It does not guarantee that the words that you speak are going to be life-giving. And so Divinity School helped me to put on a critical lens, to be able to see the ways that I was biased, the ways that I was complicit in some of this oppression and some of the harm that has been done to all of these folks in marginalized communities. But for me, it was the harm that I was doing to myself.
We in church.
Okay. This is good. This is good. I'm loving it.
It was this point where I needed to, you know, we try to make sense of suffering. And there are so many scriptures and prayers that say things like, you know, God works all things together. You know, Romans 8:28, for we know that all things work together for the good of them that love the Lord and who are called according to his purpose. And in my mind, I was thinking like, well, if all things work together, then this trauma that I experienced is supposed to produce something great, or this heartache that I've experienced, or this situation that has happened in the world, or these kids at the border, or women losing their rights, you know, to their bodies is supposed to work together. And there was a tension there. There was a disconnect. And so I was like, it looks like our country in its very Christian state has created policies and created ways of being for folks that if you don't acquiesce to this standard, you get pushed to the margins. And so for those of us that wanted to get the money, wanted to get the jobs, wanted the platform, wanted the power, we acquiesced and we did what we needed to do. But I realized that my life was at stake, and not just mine, but the folks that God was calling me to serve. And so that's when I realized that I don't want to be boxed into a tradition that is going to tell me that Jesus, 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 Jesus. Because like, if we're going to study Jesus, let's look at the character of who Jesus was. Let's look at the life that Jesus lived. You know, not just that he died for my sins, because what does that mean? Jesus died on the cross and we still have all of this sin. We still have all of this trouble. And so what is our call? What is our challenge? And it's to embody who Jesus was. And not just as a divine being, but as a decent human being. Jesus talked to folks that were left out, looked over, looked past. People that, you're not supposed to talk to that woman at the well. She's got all of these husbands. She's a hoe. You're not supposed to talk to her. Jesus is like, excuse me, I got this. You know,
it's not your job.
And so I'm learning how to communicate with people, how to understand and listen to their stories. And one of the things that someone taught me was, we don't speak for people. We aren't there's no voice for the voiceless. People have voices. People have power. And so instead of speaking for them, we get out of the way and we amplify that. And if there's a case that we have a privilege that they don't, we use it to get out of the way and to let people tell their stories. And that's why I went into chaplaincy, so that I could hear people tell their stories who were dealing with life-threatening situations, or maybe some life joys that happens. You know, in the hospital, you experience different levels of suffering. And I wanted to be trained in a way that I could understand that.
I really like that piece about the I've heard it before, the like, we are not giving a voice to the voiceless. You said that right? I did say that right. And it's actually been a couple of things that you've said that are directly like parallel to like school. Obviously, because we're schooling in America, everything that you're saying relates to it, whether people see it directly or not. But that voice of the voiceless thing, I have just heard people who are in the majority group, in whatever space, because I would go straight to white people, but sometimes people do that in black spaces too, within schooling. And it's like, we're not giving kids a voice. They literally already have a voice. And if we're going to be true educators, we're facilitating learning. We're not actually like giving the learning. I didn't hand the learning to you, put it in your brain. Like, you already have the potential and the capacity. And I'm just facilitating how you're going to get it out. Therefore, I'm not actually giving you a voice. I'm setting up a space for you to use it. So I'm glad that you said that. And then there was like a couple of other things when you were talking about the comparison between like going to divinity school and then going to Bible college. I was like, oh, that sounds like going to Teach for America and then going to a traditional teacher preparation program. And like, I'm not fluent in all these things, but there's so many parallels and so many things that make each thing similar. And what I really liked about a piece of what you said is like, essentially we need to be able to demonstrate the values that Jesus demonstrated. And I talk about this with one of my friends, Craig. He's also a practicing Christian. And because he's just such a phenomenal man. Like, I love him. I'm like, you create safe spaces. You want people to learn. You have so much patience. I'm like, how did you do that? And then he's like, these are just values I learned in the church. I've learned to like be able to listen and to be open to all people. But this is where I learned these values. And when I translate that to the classroom, like, why... I mean, there's probably a bunch of reasons, but why are you walking into my classroom and not speaking to me?
Yeah.
That's crazy. And I mean, okay, I might be at my desk, come and speak. But sometimes I'm literally at the front, at the threshold of the classroom, and students think it's okay to walk by. And you could get the fuck out and try it again, because that was the type of person that I was. Because I want to teach you the value of like, when we come into this space, we're a community. And everybody has a role and everybody is interconnected. And if we're going to be in this space for hours together, we need to make sure that we're building this relationship. Don't walk into my classroom and not speak to me. And we about to be together for 3 hours as I've helped facilitate learning. So just a bunch of parallels that I just wanted to like pick out, because I was writing my notes right here.
That's good. That's good. No, and you know, I think that I also just feel as if this conversation is helping me, because I think that there were even some, I would say some traumatic experiences that I had in the church. And so like talking through this also helps me think through the trauma. And I also would kind of like somewhat implore people to find what works for you. Like literally that's what life is about, is finding what works for you, as opposed to feeling as if you need to be evangelized to do what's right. Like you will know what's right for you. You will feel the calling that like Brandon is speaking to. And so I would even like go as far as say, I would like to hear more about like how present day, now that you are in a hospital, you're dealing with multiple different faiths. How do you kind of work through all of that?
So one of the things that brought me to chaplaincy specifically, or hospital chaplaincy, I realized that in generally, and all churches aren't the same, you know, all Black churches aren't the same, we aren't a monolith, it's very different. But in most spaces, in churches, the end goal is that you give your life to Christ, that you are converted, that you become a part of God's family, God's body. And I realized that for me, evangelism is not something that I really like, because it feels very like the treatment that we got coming over here, you know?
Yeah.
The vessels that brought us were ships called Christ the Redeemer. So I'm confused, you know?
Come on.
So one of the reasons why I came to hospital chaplaincy was because the end goal here is not evangelism. It's not proselytization, which is converting folks. The end goal is to figure out what is meaningful for folks. How do folks make meaning in their situations, in their lives? And in the hospital setting, folks show up all kinds of ways. And so our job or our training is to help explore what is meaningful for the patient and how does this impact their circumstance? How does this impact their treatment? How does this impact what they're going through in their lives, with their families, with their jobs, with their faith? And so one of the things that they drive into us is that when you go into a meeting or when you go into a visit, our end goal is not that they get saved. In my first unit of clinical pastoral education, which is what we call CPE in hospital chaplaincy, it's a training program in which we are instructed to, you know, learn how to be good chaplains. There was a lady who, we walked into the room, myself and a colleague, we're like, hi, we're chaplains. We're just here to see how you're doing. She said, I don't do that Jesus stuff. And so my first inkling was to say, and that's great. You don't have to do that Jesus stuff. We're not here to do Jesus stuff.
And good for you.
Because when people see chaplains, they either think they're dying or they think that we're trying to save them because they think that they're dying. And so my colleague at the time was like, well, maybe you should give Jesus a chance. And I was just like, whoa. You know, I didn't say that in the moment, but when we walked out of the room, I was like, maybe Jesus is not her meaning-making process. Maybe this is not her source of spiritual support. How about we ask her, how is she doing? Tell me a little bit more about why you're here. And that way we get to hear their story. And when you hear their story, you figure out what's important. You hear the values. You hear their beliefs.
Yeah.
And you ask them about it. We remain curious. What is meaningful about going fishing? What is meaningful about this necklace that your grandmother left to you? What is meaningful about being able to take walks in nature and experiencing the divine that way? And so in chaplaincy, what we do is we learn stories. We've been on this kick of learning to how to do narrative medicine. And so when you go to the doctor's office, you think of a doctor asking you, what medicines are you on? What problems do you have? Those type of things that feel very diagnostic. And sometimes they can feel judgmental. Do you work out? You know, those type of things. And so
are you a smoker?
Are you a smoker? Do you do drugs? Like, are you sexually active? And it's just like, wait a second.
Right. Like, chill out on me.
Like, you know, give me a second to breathe. And so one of the ways that we've been trained is to, or one of the ways that the doctor taught us is to say, what is it that you understand about why you're here? And what we've learned, what we've learned is that people may not have the terminology, they may not have the language to be able to medically describe or act in whatever field you're in, academically, business-wise, they may not be able to describe it in a way that's very astute or very educated. But by the time they tell their story, they know what's going on with them. And now you know what's going on with them, because we're trained to be able to extract that information to make an assessment, to make it, you know, and for, you know, some make a diagnosis, for you to figure out what your lesson plan is going to be based off of how kids are responding. And so you release shame, you release guilt, and people feel open to be able to just kind of tell their truth and to tell their story. Yeah. And that's what the heart of my work is, to hear who you are, and maybe to hear why you are, if that comes out in your story. And that's, it takes a lot to listen. Because usually when you go into a room, you want to be the expert. You want to tell people what to do. You want to say, I know better than you because I got this degree. I know better than you because I went to divinity school. No, you don't. You can get all these degrees, all these accolades, but you can't connect. When I was in divinity school, my professor, Dr. Renee Harrison, and I'll quote her, she asks us in the beginning of our History of the Black Church course, why are you here? And I was like, well, to get my credit so I can graduate.
Hello.
But she's like, no. Right. Why is Brandon in this room right now at this point in his life? And I was like, I don't know. I had to think about it for a second. And the answer that I was able to come up with was to connect. And so in my ordination process right now, I'm in the AME, I'm going through the ordination process in the AME church. We had to write a paper about what we believed evangelism was. And I was just like, it is not, I cannot say that this is about people conforming to the ways that I do things. I just don't. And I know that's traditionally the way that it looks. People see evangelism as an opportunity for people to give their lives to Christ and to become Christian. But I thought of evangelism as a means to connect. And that's something that each human being
can do.
And I'm sitting here trying to find ways to amplify or to help you to see your inalienable worth. Like, you are enough. Like, you don't need to be saved. I mean, the only thing we need to be saved from are the systems of this world. That's what we really need to be saved from.
We quite literally do.
Because if anything, Jesus would have come to show us how to live. And even Jesus had moments, and I won't preach tonight, but even Jesus got checked.
You won't?
Come on.
Even Jesus in his glory and in his, you know, power, and I don't, you know, obviously I'm a practicing Christian, so I love Jesus, but there's an account in scripture where a woman basically says, like, can I get the crumbs from the table? Can I get the crumbs? You know, can I eat? And Jesus is like, no, this is for somebody else. I came for somebody else. And she was like, even dogs can eat the crumbs. Basically, like, Jesus, she checked him. She checked God in flesh and said, even the dogs can eat the crumbs from the master's table. And so even me, there's even room for me here. And sometimes I think when we get our degrees and we get our accolades and we go through these programs and processes, we forget about that part. We aren't humble. We aren't able to be personable and relate, and people feel pushed away. And that's why I said earlier, like, I know plenty of people that have gone to divinity schools, the top schools, and still don't connect. There's still some type of miscommunication about what it is that we're doing here. And my life goal is to just connect with as many people as I can, to learn as many stories as I can, to tell my own story, right? Because it's in our sharing of grief that makes the grief a little bit lighter.
Lighter, yeah.
Just a little, it won't make it disappear, but it does make it a little bit lighter if we can do it together. So it's community oriented.
And speaking of grief, which is a crazy segue now that I've verbalized it out loud, I kind of want to bring us to like modern day and some of the places that we see religion in school today. I just hate that I have to keep talking about shootings and then also attach them to a state or a city. But I know that like the shooting in Nashville, the school shooting in Nashville, some people called for prayer at school. You know, that I feel like that happens in Christian-based schools and also non-Christian-based schools. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, especially as someone who is a practicing Christian, but also a chaplain who understands what it means to understand interfaith faith and make sure everyone in the space has some meaning from things.
Well, first of all, thoughts and prayers are empty. They are powerless. They don't do anything. Especially in the history of our country, we could go back to, Columbine. I mean, we can name all kinds of shootings from all over the place. Our elected officials have gotten before the people that have put them there to say thoughts and prayers, but we're going to continue to let people buy guns and just walk up in places and do it. And, you know, some would think that the answer to this question is that vote. I don't know that we live in a world where voting is going to save us, because the system in and of itself is just not going to work for us. It's doing what it's supposed to do in America. It's upholding all the values that America upholds, and it's working just fine for who it's supposed to work for.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm not in the business of shaming people for not going to vote, because it's like, if I voted and look what happened, you know, we got the first Black president, and this is not me going into talking about, you know, President Barack Obama's presidency.
Okay, because it's not the this not the politics episode.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go into it. But you can't talk about Jesus without talking about politics. You can't talk about church without talking about politics sometimes. And
it's very true.
One of the thoughts that I have is like, you know, what is our politic, you know? And most of the people that are wielding these gun laws or letting people do what they want to do are Christian people.
Mm.
These are the saints of God that are allowing turmoil to happen in the world. And so one of the things that I think is important for us to do is to always advocate. You know, I don't think, I'm not telling people not to go vote, but I'm telling people to be involved in your communities. And you can do that with voting, of course. And so, yes, vote. But also you can do this with getting to know the people that you're in communities with. You know, you get to know this sense of community by allowing the diversity of the ways that the people show up to be present. And when I think about interfaith, you know, I think about a sermon that the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss III preached. The first line in his sermon was, "The truth is not exclusive to the Christian vessel." And so we think because we're Christian, one nation under God, you know, indivisible. Liberty and justice for all.
And justice for all. Justice
for all.
What a curse, you know. What a tragedy, you know. And using the words, trusting in God, one nation, all of this unity. But who's getting uplifted in that, you know? And so one of the ways that I like to think about ministry, the ways that I think about the world, the ways that I think about the ways that we have to engage society is like a mosaic. Mosaics are pieces of lots of different things, or at least the ones that I'm thinking about. I was at a summer camp and we were creating an ecosystem outside of our building. And so the job was to basically excavate the ground to find all of these different pieces. And so like rocks, broken glass, buttons, feathers, all kind of things that we were basically putting on like a brick and using cement to create this one picture. And then we were bringing together all of our pictures that we made individually to create this huge masterpiece. And so I was thinking about the ways that we show up differently, just like a mosaic. We all have different stories. We all have different places that we started. Some of us have been dropped, left, and forgotten. Some of us are brand new. Some of us just got here. And so when I think about the cement that's used to like pull this picture together, I think about the love that we ought to have. And so when I'm thinking about Jesus, I'm thinking about his love for us, and not just on the cross, because that was humiliation. That was gory. That was a lynching, if you will.
Yeah.
And so Jesus's love is more than what happened on the cross. Jesus literally coming into the earth was a sign of hope for people. Like when he was born, people got excited everywhere. I mean, obviously there were people that weren't excited. But when I think about that, I think about the love that is possible in our world with our differences, and not ones that we can just tolerate. You know, I had a professor that said to tolerate something still sounds conditional. It's like, I tolerate you as long as you stay over there. But when you come over here, then that's where the problem is. So how do we live in a world where we embrace our differences and to see this as a beautiful masterpiece that mosaics usually come out to be? And when I think of that, I think of interfaith that way, and not interfaith from my definition, because then that's not interfaith. That's branded.
Mm.
But I need to hear what Lindsay is saying. I need to hear what Jihad is saying. I need to hear what the next person is saying, and to see how we can create this picture that I believe can be cohesive. But the world that we live in, as the tension that we find ourselves with the shootings, because we got folks that are Christian that think that people ought to have a right to bear arms in schools, in churches, in grocery stores, in movie theaters. I mean, like in your home by police officers. So like where have we gotten, where have we gone wrong? Mm-hmm. How do we yeah. end this thing? How can we really like become interconnected in a way that what we create is life-giving and sustaining?
Mm-hmm.
And so that death does not have to be a threat, but death could be a gift. Hmm. That the lives that we lived will allow us to transition from this one into the next one, not being threatened by guns, children, mm-hmm. you know, and it, and I mean, you could probably hear some of my just frustration with the state of our world. Cause when children yeah. are dying, I have one of my good friend's son was just killed in a shooting in Alabama 2 weeks ago. Hmm. And there is no weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Mm-hmm. Because these children mm-hmm. are dead. These people that we loved are dead. You know, not to say that good moments won't come, but they are not here because of folks that
yeah.
are professing to be Christians. You know, and so mm-hmm. how do we create this space where we can be different, where we can value our lives and value one another's lives and be able to tell our stories?
Hmm. And those are great question, because now I'm like, we put those in a call to action, baby.
That's literally it. That yeah. is literally it.
Where do you we're find in yourself? There now. Where are you signing up?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank and, you, Brandon.
Yeah.
Oh, you have more seriously. To say?
I just had one thing that okay. I will say before we sign off is, I think that if anything that resonated with me the most, it was the fact that listening is key. And I think that that is something that we will not be able to evolve without that key skill. Not speak, listen.
Listen. And with that, I hope that all of our audience members, because I mean, the whole point of this series is to uplift, to give a voice to the voiceless, Brandon, because yeah. you're voiceless. No, just kidding. But the whole purpose is to uplift voice. And hopefully, yes. I hope that like our audience that is listening right now, whether it's on YouTube and you subscribed already, go you, is actually listening to figure out like what role we can play and honestly elevating the collective consciousness and creating a space where everybody feels safe, everybody feels loved and celebrated. So Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was absolutely beautiful. Yes. And we will be talking to you soon.
Now it is time for a call to action. And this is one of my favorite portions of the episode because we don't just get to talk about all the great things that are going on in the taboo world, but we get to talk about the ways in which we get to act. And as y'all probably were able to tell, this episode, I was processing and going through a lot. And so we want to give you a couple of things to think through so that you can be a better you. Yeah, Ms. Black, so take it away.
We don't just talk about it. We're going to be about it. So we already talked about how collectively we all show up as a mosaic. And we need to be thinking about the love that we should all have for each other, because that's the stuff that's going to connect like those brightly colored pieces of glass or whatever we represent in that mosaic. So there are a couple of questions that you just heard, but I want to actually raise them because I want people to really think about them as they move through the world and they consider like what being inclusive means or what being open mm-hmm. means or what being transparent means. Because these are all important values to have in the classroom. Like yeah. we all want, when we have children, we want our kids to be accepted for who they are, right? We see on the TV screens, whether it's an actual movie or an actual, like, I don't know, like a CNN article that we're reading about kids that are not being accepted. And then we see yeah. some about kids who are being accepted and kids that are being uplifted to really dive deep into who they are. How they want to represent themselves and how they want to show up in the world. And we don't want that to just be siloed in the schools, right? Because the kids are then going to be adults that live into the world. So it is important that kids can ask themselves these questions when they get of age to be able to verbalize. But it's even more important that the adults that are listening right now are able to ask these questions and have an answer or be working towards an answer that you feel like is suitable for you and your community. Mm-hmm. So the questions are, how do we create this space where we can be different? How do we create a space where we value ourselves and also value one another's lives? And what would a world look like where people have the skills to tell their stories and people use that key skill that Jahat mentioned of listening. And those are some questions that we want to leave you with. Lots of information was provided in this episode. We appreciate you listening, and we hope that you're able to take these reflective questions and it supports you through your processing of everything that you heard.
And with that, we're out. Peace, love, and light, y'all.